It is the 21st and it's springtime, folks. Welcome to springtime. We have spring break after this, so you have plenty of time to study, right? Every day. You think I'm kidding, but this is what you need to do. I apologize. I didn't make up this system, but this is the way it is. Okay. We're going to announce an exam. Well, chapter 6 is due. These are the calculations that you need to be able to do for the next exam also. You have to be able to do them for the previous exam. You're going to have to do them for the next exam. Because we're going to, when we come back, we'll do 7 today. We might get a little bit of 8 done. And then we'll finish up 8, and then we'll have time to review the calculations. Because that's what we really want to key on, those calculations of the discounted cash flows. Some of you already know how to do these. Great. Others are going to learn again. So 17, that's the financial ratios. 7 and 8 we'll discuss the next two sessions. Chapter 5 review. All the stuff we did in 5 is game. It's going to be on the exam. Many of the same questions worded differently will be on exam number 3. Why? Because you have to know this stuff. And when you take the series 7, you're going to take these exams over and over and over again. And then the chapter 6 calculations, we'll review some of those next Tuesday. You get to use both formula sheets from chapter 6 and 17, a page of notes in addition to the formula sheets, Scantron and calculator. Any questions, any thoughts, ideas, comments? Are you going to be studying over the vacation? Okay, good. I hope so. And I did make the copies of chapter 7, and I completely lost them, and I found them again, so I have extras in case anybody did not get a chapter 7 and 7 and 8 from Tuesday. You were not here. But first, we need a good joke. Anybody not here on Tuesday?
First?
Yes, 17, 7, and 8. Now, 17 is the calculations, right? We did the ratio calculations, so there'll be some ratio calculations on the exam. But they're straightforward. You need your page of notes, right?
You didn't have any page of notes.
One page of notes, handwritten front and back, plus the two formula sheets. I'll have extras. I'll have extra formula sheets. But you got the formula sheet. And then 7 and 8, we're going to find that this is a lot of fluff the next two sessions. But you need to know it because it's part of the stock world. And then there's the meat, chapter 5. You have to learn, go back and relearn, review all those things about stocks and dividends and different types of stocks and different types of investment theories and capitalization and odd lots. 5 and 6 is just calculations. And we'll review the calculations again. We'll review...
5 again?
Yeah, exactly. You see, I want you to know it. You understand? I want you to notice, right? If you're going to know one thing when you leave, it's going to be how to discount a series of future cash flows. Before you leave this class, you will know if you get a C. Or better. All right. So, we're going to do chapter 7. Where's chapter 7? There's chapter 7. But first, we need a good joke. Anybody got a good joke? We started the Battle of the Sexes jokes on Tuesday, right?
Yeah.
Well, did you hear about the woman who was so excited, she slammed up the minivan, screeched the tires, yelled, burst open the door, yelled out, "Honey, pack your bags, I won the lottery!" And the husband was so excited, he said, "Wow, that's great, what should I pack, beach, mountain?" She said, "I don't care, just get the hell out of here!" Get out, I won the lottery, go away. Interesting shirt there, Gilbert. Where do you keep the batteries? All right, so here we go. We're ready to start some silliness. Stock price behavior and market efficiency. And as we said, Mr. Isaac, none other than Sir Isaac Newton, knew all about the madness of men. And we're going to learn about some of the madness here. But a better name for this chapter might be, Can You Beat the Market? So we're also going to look at, I've added all, these are from the book, I've added All Stars of Investing to that. There's so much money involved in stock investing, right, that everybody gets into the act. Even people in the academic world. Even the business professors and finance professors. And around the late 1960s, early 1970s, they were starting to come up with some theories to try to describe what's going on in the real world. And one of them was the random walk theory. The idea that stock price movements are completely unpredictable, because the holy grail, of course, would be, could you predict the short-term behavior of the market, right? Because if you could do that, you could print money. Just as if you could predict which horse was going to win tomorrow at the racetrack. And what the academics proved using statistical theory, using significantly statistical hypotheses, and if you've taken statistics, you know how to do these, is that stock price movements are completely random. In the short term. In the short term, they do appear random. There's only been one company that was generally acknowledged as being able to predict the short-term behavior of the market in the 1990s, a company by the name of Long Term Capital Management. And, you know, the first few years they made gobs of money, and then they failed miserably and almost brought down the market with them. In the long term, if you look at the long-term behavior of stocks and the stock market as a whole, so S&P 500, MSCI World, we find that there is not randomness. As the economy grows, as more and more people come out of poverty, and the standard of living rises for people around the world, the companies that supply those goods and services, those products, have done well. So in the long term, we hope, because failure is not an option. Could the entire system break apart, crack, and fall on its side? Could it happen? Yeah, there's people predicting it every other day. These are the people who tell you to buy gold and guns and bottled water and canned goods and spaceships. Yeah, right. And they, along with that, after they showed that they were correct with the random walk, they came up with what's called the efficient market theory. Now, we have learned fundamental analysis. We just scratched the surface. But the stuff that we did in chapter 6 and 17 is called fundamental analysis. In chapter 8, we're going to take a quick look at what's called technical analysis. And these were, and still are, the two major strategies for researching and deciding what's going to happen with stocks and stock market in general. And the efficient market theorists from their ivory towers very prestigious universities, not at the community college level. The efficient market theorists came up with a theory that said, well, you know what? They're both wrong. An efficient market is a market in which securities reflect all possible information quickly and accurately. And if there are large numbers of knowledgeable investors who react quickly to new information, security prices will adjust quickly and accurately. So in other words, a market exchange like the New York Stock Exchange, like the NASDAQ, like the Frankfurt and the Tokyo and the London exchanges, where there are millions of buyers and millions of sellers doing business in the marketplace, that's an efficient market. And much of this research was really described perfectly by one of the professors who did it in the book that I've already referenced and told you about called The Random Walk Down Wall Street. This guy's a whole lot of fun. He skewers the fundamental analyst, he skewers the technical analyst, and he skewers the efficient, he skewers his own group. He does a really good job and has fun doing it. And you actually learn something. So that's enough. But read one up on Wall Street first. So, at the time, in the early 1970s, mid-1970s, there were physicists who were breaking down the atom and finding out what was going on inside, and they had these different theories, the weak, the semi-strong, the strong, and so the academics in the finance world started stealing from them. The weak efficiency hypothesis. Past data on stock price are of no use in predicting future prices. And you notice you can say past data is or past data are, because data is both single and plural. Past data are of no use in predicting stock prices. However, stock prices do tend to demonstrate momentum, as we've seen. We've seen people raise the price of stocks more often than they fall. Why? Because the economy is growing. More and more people are coming out of poverty and joining the middle class, and the standard of living is grading for all. And stock prices tend to move far higher than is usually justified. We call those manias or bubbles. Or far lower than is usually warranted. That's called a crash. So John Maynard Keynes, I think, said it best when a group of investors who were saying, the market's way too high, or the market would be way too low, it depends, you know, whichever one. In this case, it was way too high. And he agreed. He said, yes, you're absolutely right, but the market can stay irrational longer than you can stay solvent. So in other words, a whole group of people could be bidding up prices much higher than it is warranted, and that can continue for a whole lot longer than you can bet against them. Because if you do bet against them, and that we'll learn about shorting, selling short later on, how to do it, you can lose a lot of money quickly. And the same thing is true when stock prices fall to levels that are unwarranted, they're too low. If this theory is true, which obviously it doesn't look very true, you know, they're saying, you know, past data on stock prices, then technical analysis is useless. Because technical analysis will use the past price movements to predict the future. And we'll take a look at technical analysis in detail in Chapter 8. The next one is the semi-strong efficiency. You like that name, semi-strong? Abnormally large profits cannot be consistently earned using publicly available information. In other words, no amount of analysis that you do to determine the future price of a stock will help you beat the market, will help you do better than if you just threw darts at a dartboard. But, as we'll see, and as we've seen, there are many investors who have done better than the market over significant periods of time, 5, 10, 20, 30 years. We saw some mutual funds that have done over 10, 11% over decades, remember? What does this theory say? Because this theory is saying, hey, there's nobody that can beat the market. So in other words, the fundamental analysts who are doing the research that we did with Chapter 6, where we looked at their future cash flows and their future stock price, you can't do it. You can't beat the market. And yet, there are many who have done it. So when you have a theory that says something, but it's... it says this can't happen, but it happens. What do? Yeah, you just say, well, those people are just lucky. Because think about it, exactly. If you had 100,000 people, and everybody's just guessing out which stock to buy, and there's most of them are going to fail. But maybe two or three of them are going to be successful, just because they're lucky, because there's a whole bunch of people doing that. When you take the numbers, though, it turns out that the number of people who have beat the market over time, that would happen maybe one every 268,000 years over the last 20 years. It might, you know, if you had a series of random occurrences. So we just happen to be really, really, really lucky. And what I like to think of is the very famous quote from a golfer. And if you go online, you'll see that it's attributed to a bunch of golfers, so obviously we don't know who the real one is. He did really, really well. Right? He made a lot of money, beat all the other golfers, and the reporter said, you are lucky out there. You are really lucky out there. And he said, you know, you're absolutely right. And the funny thing is, the more I practice, the luckier I get. The more I practice, the luckier I get. Okay. Not really lucky. Can you hit that little white ball 400 yards in a straight line and get it on a little hole that big? Yes. Multiple, yeah, 18 times, right? Exactly. Can you swing a bat at a fastball going 98 miles an hour?
Yeah.
What? Not me. 60 was fast enough for me. I was scared. What? 60
is fast.
60 is fast. You're getting those batting cages. Someone told me now they go up to 70. You can go up to 70 at the batting? Not for the general public.
No?
No. I don't know. Maybe. I don't know. I would think you'd have to go to a baseball training field. What? Oh, yeah. Can you imagine the insurance for that thing? Can you imagine? Because the machine doesn't screw up normally. You know, it comes right across the plate every time. But if it ever screwed up and hits you at 70 miles an hour or at 90 miles an hour, who is the one? There was more than one, but one baseball player lost his eyesight. He got hit in the side of the head and he lost his eyesight. So can you hit that? You know, if you can do that, then you ain't lucky. You just wanted to, exactly. You're just really good at what you can do. And if you can do that, you can make a lot of money. So if this theory is true, and it certainly doesn't seem true, then fundamental analysis that we learned in chapter 6 is useless. So everything we did in chapter 6, these people are saying, isn't going to help you. Now, I told you it's not going to make you, the next Peter Lynch, but my belief is that it's going to tilt the odds in your favor and help you. What?
In the long run?
In the long run. I think it will. I hope it will. I'm certainly trying. You know, I was. I'm not doing it now. Now I'm doing real estate, and boy, is that a pain in the ass. I'll tell you that. Okay. Strong. This is where it really gets ridiculous. The strong. Efficiency hypothesis. No amount of information, public or private, allow investors to earn abnormally large profits consistently. Wait a minute. One insider trade. If you knew tomorrow a drug company was going to have their drug approved or disapproved, and you knew that before everybody else knew it, you could make $1 million overnight. Over, but you could also go to jail. Because what is that called? We call it insider trading. That's the common term for it. But what the Securities and Exchange Commission calls it is material non-public information. If you have material non-public information, because you're the president of the company or the CE or the CFO, the financial officer, or you're the lawyer, you understand what I'm saying? You know, or you're the person who put together all the data. You're the accountant or the bookkeeper who put together all the data. If you knew that and you traded on that information, that's illegal. And if you told your buddy to do it and he did it or she did it because you told them, you see what's going on here? Well, that's the NFL's going. Okay. Who was it? Martha Stewart. You heard Martha Stewart. Now, I did my best for many years not to even know who she was. I don't like recognizing celebrities. That's the one thing. I would never want to be famous. I would never. I mean, maybe my voice if I did a radio show or something like that. But I never want to have my pictures all over, because then wherever you go, people go, "Oh, hi! I saw you on TV." Like, okay. She got in trouble. Why? Because her ex-boyfriend was the CEO of a drug company, and he knew that the FDA was going to disapprove their drug, and he started selling his shares. Now, I don't know if I got the story completely straight, but the stockbroker was the stockbroker in common between the two of them. I don't think they were together anymore. I think it was her ex-boyfriend or something like that. The stockbroker told her that Sam is selling his shares. His name was Sam, right? I guess it still is. And so what did she do? She started selling her shares, right? And the Securities Exchange caught it. Because they have computer algorithms that go around sniffing for this kind of activity. If there's a huge increase in certain types of activity before a piece of information comes out, and it was to their benefit, they zero in. Well, they got the stockbroker to turn state's evidence, it's called. In other words, to squeal. To say, yeah, I'm sorry, I did it.
Stool pigeon.
And they went up to Martha Stewart and said, look, we got you. You should fess up. You'll pay a fine and probably get a suspended sentence. And she said, no. We didn't do it. Now, no one will ever admit to this, because she didn't go to jail for the insider trading. She didn't go to jail for trading on material non-public information. She went to jail for lying about it and obstructing the investigation. Perjury is far worse than this, what she did. And I am sure her publicists said, go to jail. You'll do 4 or 5 months, maybe 6 months at the most. You can't buy that kind of publicity. You'll be in the news. There'll be pictures of you showing the inmates how to make turkey or whatever. And, you know, they'll be... You can't buy that kind of publicity. And sure enough, after she came out, right, what happened? The stock price of her company went way up. So you understand? What? Crime pays. You're your own boss. The hours are good. But you got to be careful. Some crime, no. Don't knock over a liquor store. Don't rob a bank. But white collar crime, yeah. So you with me? Understand this? You understand this? The random walk and efficient market theorists are often major proponents of index funds. They point to the fact that many professional money managers simply do not beat the market. You go out there and look at all the mutual funds out there, and many don't beat the market. Well, think about it, folks. If you're a mutual fund manager and you have 1 or 2% fees every year, do you understand you have to beat the market by 1 or 2% just to break even? You already have one hand tied behind your back. And if you're at a mutual fund company that rewards short-term behavior and not long-term behavior, you have to roll the dice. You have to... What? Whoa. I don't understand. Roll the dice. You have to roll the dice. You have to shoot for the whatever they call it, you know, shoot for the moon, shoot for the fences. I hate using... sports analogies. They seem to work. The Hail Mary pass. You have to go for the real risky stocks. You can't play it safe. The way we looked in chapter 6, where we looked at the Coca-Colas of the world and the G's of the world and the Johnson & Johnsons. What? Exactly. But what happens often, you baseball fans, when you try to swing for the fences, what do? You strike out, right? And you throw the Hail Mary pass in football. What happens? It gets intercepted. Right? And so they got two hands tied behind their backs. And that's the reason a lot of mutual fund managers don't beat that. And these people, these efficient market theorists and random walk theorists, they believe you should stick with index funds. They reason you are better off accepting close to the market's return with low-cost index funds, since their theory tells them that no one can consistently beat the market. You understand? Even though... they see that there are some mutual fund managers and other money managers who have beaten the market over long periods of time. And as we said, they say they're lucky. But it reminds me of the bumblebee. And why is that? Well, we have only been flying, humans have only been flying a little over 100 years, right? I mean, I guess you could call balloons flying, but the aeroplanes, you know, flying machines, right? And very quickly... the engineers figured out what was going on, the aerodynamics, and they applied their theory to insects and birds and tried to figure out, you know, how are these things flying. And they came up, their theory told them that the bumblebee, not the honeybee, but the big one, right? The bumblebee, the pink, yeah, the big fuzzy one, shouldn't be able to fly. The theory says that it can't fly. Because of its weight and its wingspan, and they're thinking, what's going on here? Good thing nobody told the bumblebee, right? It wasn't until the late 1990s that they thought, oh, this is what they're doing. Well, we didn't think of that. Maybe we could, you know, steal from them. Why can't many pros beat the averages? Well, as we said, many mutual funds have high annual operating expenses and high turnover rates. And many mutual fund managements have a very short-term time horizon. Consequently, many mutual fund managers have a very short lifespan. Because if your company says you better produce in 18, 24 months, and you roll the dice, or I don't know, shoot for the moon, whatever analogy you want to use, and you lose, oh well, you're out of there. But you were going to be out of there anyway. If you win, you get to keep your job, you get showered with millions of dollars. But the premises and the casual observations of the efficient market theorists show them to be patently absurd. Many money managers, and we'll take a look at them, have beaten the market over long periods of time. The more I practice, the better I get. And if markets are efficient and rational, how do you explain manias? How do you explain them? Because they happen every so often, and we all get caught up, and we always say, it's different this time. It's a new era. The old ways are gone. Occasionally, investors get caught up in what are called manias, also called bubbles. So mania bubble means the same thing. The internet bubble of the 1990s was the latest stock mania. And some of you were very young, but any company that had .com in its name, or had anything to do with telecommunications, or anything to do with computers, as soon as it went public, whoosh, the stock became instant. Large cap, huge company. Even though they acknowledged that they weren't going to make any money for several years, they were losing money, didn't matter. People would just, they'll buy it. Before that, there was the Nifty 50 of the early 1970s, and most of you weren't allowed, were alive. Yeah, with technology, Calcomp, Tektronix. You've heard of these companies, right? Haven't you? Tektronix, you never heard? If you're in the military, you probably had one of their Tektronix oscillators. Machines, test equipment, electrical test equipment. A Polaroid. Have you ever heard of Polaroid?
Yeah.
Went bankrupt in 1998. The name still lives on, though. That name, I don't know why. I would not want to invest in a company whose name rhymes with hemorrhoid. I just don't think it's not a good analogy. Anyway, in the 1920s, there were the same thing going on. Have you ever heard of Radio Corporation of America?
Radio
Corporation of America. You know it as RCA?
Yeah.
Yeah. It was $293 at the height of the mania in 1929. In 4 years, in 1933, it was $2. Yeah, and it's never recovered. It's never gone back to its height. It's actually gone now. I think somebody bought the name. In the 1840s, there were 400 railroad firms. How many are there now? Three, basically. Well, actually, it's a few more, but they're private. But less than a handful. And the granddaddy of all. Have I told you this one yet?
The tulip
bulb craze. Did I tell you about this yet? The tulip bulb. In the other class, I talked about it. Yeah. And there's two books that you really should read. This one, definitely. Extraordinary Popular Delusions and the Madness of Crowds. And this one's a lot of fun, but it's more about plants, believe it or not. But in the early 1600s, tulip bulbs were imported to Europe. I think they came from Turkey. And they were all the rage. And tulip bulbs started to be traded like securities, like stocks, like bonds, like mutual funds. And the price skyrocketed to the point where one tulip bulb at the height of the mania would sell for what today would be $1.5 million. See, are people rational? Are people efficient? No, we're nuts. We're crazy. We fall into these extraordinary popular delusions and madnesses, as Sir Isaac Newton talked about. And each time you'll have people say, oh, it's a new era. It's different this time. It's the old ways of valuing stock are gone. And each time they were wrong. So you as an investor are going to experience these. We already have. The last mania had nothing to do with stocks, folks. It wasn't the stock market. In 2007 and 8, what created the mania?
Real estate.
Real estate. And before the real estate mania of 1929, 28, 27, 29, before the stock mania of the late 20s, there was a real estate bubble down in Florida. People were sold swampland in Florida. And so they're going to happen again. And you as an investor are going to have to do your best to not heed the siren call. That doesn't mean you shouldn't stay away from these things, but you have to be defensive. And hopefully the tools that we learned in chapter 6 will help you. Why do manias occur over and over again? Why haven't investors learned their lessons? Because we're human. That's right. Because we're human. We see a bunch of people run this way, what do? We run that way. It's part of our genes. We can't help it.
Okay, all these people are making a whole bunch of money, so
yeah. And then people run the other way. What do? We run the other way. And it helped us 1,000 years ago, 100,000 years ago, because the people who did, right, not the dinosaurs, they were long gone, but the tiger, right? The people who did, they were like, look at all these people running that way. They were the people that got eaten by the tiger, right? They didn't get to pass on their genes. Here's a great quote. It's true. Here's a great
And then they killed it.
Unless they killed it, and then all the ladies would go after him. Market manias. Market manias will happen over and over again because the public is infinitely stupid. I love that quote. Here's how Benjamin Graham says it in The Intelligent Investor. The speculative public is incorrigible. See, he used the word speculation. It will buy anything at any price if it seems to be, if there seems to be some kind of action in it. As I said, if you're making money, I want to make it too. Me some too. It will fall for any company identified with franchising, computers, electronics, science, technology, what have you, when the particular fashion is raging. The abuses are so largely the result of the public's own heedlessness and greed. Remember the woman who said, I don't even know the name of the company, but I do know this. She didn't even know the name of the company. She didn't even know what it did. All she knew is that her friend told her it was going to double in 8 months, and here were the 4 call letters to type into the computer. Now, see, Ben was writing in 1972, and the technology was a little different then. If you replace franchising computers, etc., with internet, biotechnology, good old Ben could have been writing in 2000 instead of 1972. Today, what are the buzzwords? Mobile, social networking, China. Right? Not China's getting a little tarnishing, isn't it? Yeah, China's a little tarnished. So are you going to get caught up in a mania?
No.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. And how do manias end? Exactly. I love the saying. I have it there. The bigger the party, the bigger the hangover. Oh boy. They are not fun, but the odds are you will live through at least one during your investing career. What? We did it, but did you have money in the market then? You're glad you didn't, but that would have been a good time to start, right? And here's somebody who in 1999 said this, and they thought this guy was nuts. Hey, you old buddy-duddy, go out. You need to retire. And he did the next year. With this many strong years, I have the concern that there are a vast majority of companies that are significantly overvalued on a long-term basis. This was August 1999. In that year, the Standard & Poor's went up like 29%. The NASDAQ went up 85%. He had almost 50 years of experience. The next year, 2000, he retired with 50 years of experience just before the wheels fell off. Oh, by the way, as we said, the market crash in 2008 was not caused by stock market. It was the real estate bubble and specifically the mortgage-backed bonds, the mortgage-backed securities, mortgage-backed bonds that we'll talk about when we get to chapters 9 and 10 that were tied to the real estate mortgages. So it wasn't the stock market, it was the bond market, and it was the real estate market that the bond market was tied to. So let's take a look at 11 of the very worst days of the Dow Jones Industrial Average. Now the Dow Jones has been around since 1896, and here are 11. And you see the net change, right? But these numbers are not adjusted for inflation. What we need to look at is the percentage. We saw the worst day, October 19th, Black Monday, 1987, and we saw that people thought the world was going to end. And did it? No. It came back. And look at, there's 1929, 2 days in a row when the market lost 12 and 11%. So this happened all in one day, 23%. This happened 23% in 2 days. And then 1929, a couple weeks later. 1907, there's another, 1887, you know, a week later when it fell a bunch, next week later. And then 2008 made it into the mix. The thing about 2008 is it lost 22% in 1 week, over the course of a week. Now, what I want you to notice, you note anything interesting about this? How many Octobers are there?
Six.
Six Octobers, and then there's one early November? Why? Why is October showing up? What?
Halloween.
There are many. You're right. I think he's right. We can't know. There are many theories about why this happened. Some people say, oh, it's tax selling. No, it's not. That would be in December, right? And other people say, oh, they don't know what. But the real reason, I believe, and I think Victor believes, and there's no way to prove this, is that we're not rational. We are humans. As much as we'd like to ignore that fact, because we have conquered nature. You walk inside, turn the lights on, you press a button, heat comes on, you fire up a machine that can multiply two integers millions of times a second, and you can communicate with anybody around the world. Doesn't matter! We're still animals. We still smell, we still feel, we still taste and touch, and poop and burp and fart. And 1,000 years ago, 10,000 years ago, 100,000 years ago, when October rolled around, what was going on? The days are getting shorter, the nights are getting longer, it's getting colder, the crops are dying. Well, I hope not, but witch hunt, yeah. Depression, what do we call it now? Seasonal affect order. You looked around. Everybody looked around at one another and said, you know what? The winter's coming, and one or two of us out of four or five are going to be gone, because people didn't live through the winter. They didn't have central heating and antibiotics and maybe not enough food. And there's a reason why All Hallows Eve, Halloween, Day of the Dead, is in the fall. We even call it the fall. Are you with me?
Yeah.
So there's no way to prove this. But as far as I'm concerned, this is the reason why. Because when you study humans, you realize we're not rational. We're still animals. Questions, thoughts, ideas? Is this interesting, or is my God, this is boring?
The best time to cycle fall down is during October.
But see, sometimes October's the worst month has actually been September, over the long term, as we'll see. The two worst months are September and October. September and October are the two worst months. But you're right. A lot of people wait until the end of the year before they put money in. They just wait. Now, every September and October are not bad, but a lot of people will wait there. And in fact, the last few years, August was worse. It was August. I guess people were anticipating it. They were selling before September and October, thinking, okay, I'll get back in September and October. And they sold in August, and August dumped. And then September and October are actually pretty good. So figure that one out. So now, do you recall this? How are we doing for time? Not great. Let's go faster. Do you recall this slide from chapter 4? Recall that there are many people out there, and you may be one of them. It's up to you. Everybody has a different strategy. Who recommend that you only go with index funds, low-cost index funds. So just watch out for the high-cost index funds if they slip into your 401k. Because nobody can beat the market. But the problem with index funds and ETFs, exchange-traded funds, which are mostly index funds, is that they are prone to being hit by these manias, these bubbles. They're not immune from that. In fact, it gets worse in an index fund because the index fund has to buy the shares in the same proportion. And as a company gets larger, they are required to buy more and more shares. So remember Apple last year, when it just kept going up and up and up and up? The index funds have to buy more shares. When prudence would tell you this is the time to stay away from Apple. It's a great company long term, I think. I think it's going to do well. Personally, we saw what Value Line said. But as people are bidding it up, it becomes part of its own little mania. And then, of course, it crashed last year, at the end of the year, and it's still sort of bouncing along the bottom, in my humble opinion. Doesn't mean I'm right. Now would be the time to buy Apple, right? But the index fund has to sell Apple. Because as its market cap gets smaller and smaller and smaller, they have to stay in the proportion that it is in the index. Do you understand? You understand? Yes? Not, nod your head yes? I guess. So let's go back and take a look. Here was Japan. Most of you weren't alive, but in 1980s, Japan was the new thing. They were going to take over the world. Their stock market went straight to the moon and went up to like 38,000. And so you bought the MSCI EFA. Remember what the EFA is? What's the EFA?
Foreign.
Foreign, right. International, outside the United States. Europe, Australia, and the Far East. And you thought you were getting a broadly diversified index with Europe, Australia, the Far East, including Japan and Singapore and Hong Kong. And yet what you were actually buying was 60% Japan. 60% of the EFA was Japan with a PE of almost 52. Now you understand PE better, right?
Yep.
Is that a high PE?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. That's outrageous. That's not going to last. Either the earnings had better keep growing exponentially, or that price is going to fall down. 40% was Australia, Singapore, Hong Kong, and Europe. Are you with, and Canada. Are you with me? Understand? And the same thing happened with the internet bubble. The Standard & Poor's 500 at the end of the 1990s, everybody thought you can't go wrong. It's returned 15% for 15 years, 18% for 10 years. And yet you were buying fully one-third into the internet and telecom and computers and software with a PE of almost 60, where the old economy, those are the terms that you heard, you don't hear them as much anymore, new economy, old economy, the railroads and the REITs and the basic materials and the consumer products and the healthcare and the energy companies, they were all selling at a still pretty high PE of 19, not that high, but pretty high, but that made up two-thirds. The S&P 500 over the next 2.5 years between March of 2000 and October of 2002 dropped almost 50%. The NASDAQ, tech-heavy NASDAQ, dropped 80%. Are you with me? Index funds are not perfect. And I hope what we're showing you over this semester is that nothing is. Nothing is perfect. There are advantages and there are disadvantages. Cool. All right. Now, let's take a look at some anomalies, silly theories, and oddities. Timing theories. The Monday effect. That's the best day to buy. Wait. No, it's the best day to sell. The January effect. As January goes, so goes the year. Well, sometimes it works. Sometimes it doesn't. The Santa Claus rally. At the end of the year, people tend to get happy. I don't know why. Holidays. And the stocks go up. Does it always happen? No. Sometimes they go down. If it goes down, they always say it's tax selling. They always have a saying for something. If it goes up, oh, Santa Claus. If it goes down, oh, tax selling. Sell in May and go away. Well, the truth is, folks, the best months have been from November to March. And the worst months have been through the summer and then September and October in the worst months. So you'll hear people say, sell in May and go away. Well, that's absolutely stupid. Because first of all, sometimes if everybody else is selling, if everybody were to do that, what would happen to the prices in May? They would plummet at just the time they get ready to sell. And then they would come back up at just the time you're ready to buy in November. So see, if everybody did it, you see how it would be screwballish. And then this one right here. And it's true. September and October, over the long term, have been the worst months. But the difference is very small. Less than 1%. So can you imagine trying to trade on that information? I can't. Now this one, every year, the Super Bowl rolls around, and it's one of the things where we have Roman numerals, right? Because there are gladiators out there on the field. And supposedly the Super Bowl theory is if the National League wins, or a football league team that used to be in the National League, or started in the National League, if they win, the stock market's going to go up. If the American League wins, the stock market's going to go down. So who won this year? American or national? Baltimore. Hey, but see, that's okay. Because they used to be from the NFL, right? They used to be in the original NFL. That means the stock market's going to go up this year. And the weird thing, folks, is that it's been true most of the time.
Wait, really?
Do, 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 do. And you say, well, what's going on now? What's going on? And it gets a lot of press because it's been true. Well, when you think about all the thousands of different things that are going on at any one time, can you say coincidence? What? I can't hear you.
Okay.
What did you say?
I think not.
Oh, you think not? You think it's a coincidence? I think it's a coincidence, too. Much is made over, actually, about 10, 12 years ago. The Wizard of Oz, the movie, and The Dark Side of the Moon, the album by Pink Floyd. If you start the movie and start the album at the same time, the songs change as the scenes change. And somebody went, and they went back to the folks in Pink Floyd and their producer, Alan Parsons, and the producer, you know, Gilmore and Roger Waters. And they said, you're out of your mind. We weren't thinking about the Wizard of Oz when we made the album. When you think of the thousands of movies and the thousands of albums, okay, it makes sense. Hemlines of skirts. When there's mini skirts, the stock market goes up. Well, the 1920s and 1960s, the stock market went up. And then the stock markets went down in the 1930s and 70s. They were long skirts, so they look at the skirts. And then there are many other. The lipstick indicator, lipstick, so supposedly when women buy more lipstick. The Boston snow indicator, which I love. It's called the BS indicator. The hot waitress indicator, the aspirin count. When more aspirin, stock market goes down. Yeah, right. I got to go look it up. I can't remember. What is the hot waitress one? I don't remember. But the best is politics. Now, what is poly? Many ticks or blood-sucking insects, right? which party, when the president is in office, which party do you think is better for the stock market?
Republicans.
Come on. Who thinks it's the Republicans? Who thinks it's Democrats? It's Democrats. Now, is it because it's the Democratic president? Does the president really have that much to do with the economy? No. We want to ascribe the all-powerful Superman, you know, he can do anything, she can do anything. But the truth is, no. And the reason the Republicans have done so badly, a lot of it is just dumb, bad luck. Hoover in the late 20s and early 30s, Nixon in 73, 74, and Bush in 2000 to 2002, and then 2008. And then Obama, who they hate, you know, they absolutely hate the guy, he's been one of the best presidents. Why? Dumb luck. He comes in at a time when the market has collapsed 50% and comes back up 100%, he gets the credit. Does he deserve it?
No.
No, but it doesn't matter. That's how it works. He gets it anyways. Right, that's the way the world works. That's why Obama and Romney were so, you know, they could just see each other hating each other. Because they knew whoever's going to win, the economy's going to, should. We'll see. Whoever wins is going to get the credit, even though they don't really have that much to do with it. Figure that one out. Okay, now let's take some time. Are you okay? Yeah? I could talk about this for more longer than most people would want to hear. What happened? What? The bumblebee flight. Look it up. I forget exactly. It was something they were doing with their wings at the same time they were doing something with their legs or something like that. They were almost like jumping as they were flying. I got
it.
Yeah, that's why they kind of go like this. Go read it. I can't remember. But I thought it was so cool. Because, you know, the theories are going, you shouldn't be able to fly. He's flying around. He's like, you're not listening to me. Get back on the floor. All right, so all stars are investing. All right, you're going to read One Up on Wall Street, right?
Yeah.
Everybody say right.
Yeah.
Wait till I ask you. You're going to read One Up on Wall Street?
Yeah.
Yes. Peter Lynch, he ran the Fidelity Magellan from 1977 to 1989, 29% a year. And you think, oh, he was a genius. He bought all these high-tech companies. No, he bought Dunkin' Donuts and Taco Bell.
Smart.
Yeah, you know, he bought companies that he thought were great products and he thought people would like them, and it turned out he was right. Warren Buffett, he was the student of Benjamin Graham. And you heard of him, the Sage of Omaha. He's very candid, very down to earth, still lives in the same tract house suburban house that he lived in for...
Warren Buffett,
yeah. Except there's $1 million of security equipment all around the thing. He says, don't buy a stock, buy a company. In other words, if you had enough money to buy FedEx, or if you had enough money to buy Nike, to buy the company, and you would, I mean, if you would want to own Nike, or FedEx, or whatever company we're talking about, okay, great, buy 10 shares. Buy the 20 shares. Do you understand? Don't buy the stock. Think about buying the company, if you could own the entire company. Of course, he's big enough now. The guy just bought Heinz ketchup. You've heard of Heinz? Yeah. Turn it off. You've heard of Heinz?
Yeah.
You've heard of Heinz ketchup? Okay. He bought a railroad a couple years ago, Burlington Northern. Benjamin Graham was Warren Buffett's teacher. He's often called the father of investing. And you are eventually going to read The Intelligent Investor, right? Not good yet. Read one up on Wall Street first. And then Sir John Templeton, one of the first mutual fund managers to invest globally. And then poor Bill Miller. Do you feel badly for poor Bill Miller? Don't feel badly. He did really well, but he's got to retire now. He was the fund manager of the Legg Mason Value Trust. Remember that mutual fund we looked at? That did really, really, really well, and then crashed and burned. For 15 years in a row, he beat the Standard & Poor's 500. Unprecedented. Nobody's ever done it. It reminds me of that guy, Tony Gwynn, any baseball fans? How many times did he win the batting championship? 7 times, was it? Nobody's ever going to do that again. I don't think so. I don't think this happens once, you know, every 20,000 years. He became, unfortunately for him, as far as I was concerned, the financial media's megastar. Can you imagine trying to do your job with people listening to every word you're saying, the spotlights in your eyes, all over your back looking over what you're doing? It would drive me insane. What happened is in 2006 and 7 and 8, he did really poorly. I mean, he just stunk the place up, and that 10-year return of $10,000 went from $34,000 down to $6,000 because he made large bets. His mutual fund had 40 stocks or 45 stocks. How much does a typical mutual fund have? You should know this. Take a guess. You don't have to be right. 20? No, that's the least they can have. The 20 is the least they can have. 150, 200, some have 300, 400, 500, S&P 500. So he seemed to redeem himself in 2009 when he was up over 40%, beating the 26% return of the S&P 500. But then he did badly in 2010 and 2011, and they allowed him to retire at the end of 2012. So I was surprised they let him stay on as long as they did. But don't feel badly for poor Bill Miller. What do all these people have in common? They have the courage to not follow the crowd because the conventional wisdom is not always very wise, folks. If everybody's running that way, maybe you need to walk along, but don't run. An eye for unrecognized value. What I like to think of as a sixth sense. That eye for you. Everybody else sees this and you see, ooh, they're missing this. Ooh. Gary Kasparov and Anatoly Karpov. Have you heard of these two people? They were the two best chess players in the world in the late 80s into the 90s. And each one won the championship, and the next year the other one beat them, and they were beating each other. And during that time, Gary Kasparov, he went on to fight the computer, Deep Thought. Did you hear about that one? He went up to the computer, and then he lost to Watson. He was asked why they were the two best chess players in the world. His answer was astonishingly simple and direct. We attack better than anybody else, and we defend better than anybody else. Understand? It ain't bragging if you can do it. These people bought the best companies. They bought the Dunkin' Donuts of the world, the FedExes, the Nikes, and they avoided the worst companies, the Kodaks. Speaking of avoidance, as a mutual fund investor, which I am, I'm not looking to find the next Peter Lynch or the next Bill Miller or the next Warren Buffett. No. I'm looking to avoid the next Charles Stedman. Have you ever heard of Charles Stedman? There's a reason why you've never heard of Charles Stedman. He ran his own mutual fund, the Stedman American Industry Fund. He named it after himself. That's a bad sign. From December 1959 until his death when he mercifully died in late 1997. And his cumulative total return during the greatest run-up of the economy in the history of the world was negative 42.9%. I mean, talk about bad. He had stick-to-itiveness and he was incompetent. That's a bad combination. You know, if you're bad at something, try it. You're bad at it. Do something else. No, not this guy. He would have done much better simply placing his investors' funds into a savings account in a bank or putting it under the mattress. He would have done better. I don't know, maybe because of the life insurance industry. Here's what Warren Buffett says. Be fearful when others are greedy. Be greedy when others are fearful. It's easier said than done, isn't it? His mentor, Benjamin Graham, said it this way. Buy when most people, including the experts, are overly pessimistic, and sell when they are actively optimistic. So when everybody's going, oh, the world's going to end, the world's going to end, that's when you buy. Ah, look at it, blue skies, we're all going to be rich, quick, run down, they're giving away free money, that's when you sell. It's not easy to do. And here's Sir John Templeton. Bear markets are born of pessimism, grow on skepticism, mature on optimism, and die on euphoria. The time of maximum pessimism is the best time to buy. So when everybody else thinks the world's going to end, that's when you swoop in. On a similar note, he also said, to buy when others are despondently selling and sell when others are avidly buying requires the greatest fortitude and pays the greatest reward. Now, did he follow his own advice? You think he did? Yeah, he did. You guys are excited, but I don't know. December 1941. Tell me what happened in December 1941.
Pearl Harbor.
The Nazis had already taken over all of Europe. They didn't get Britain. They wanted Britain, but they're leaving it alone. Bad mistake. And they are now in Russia. Soviet Union. Looks like the Soviet Union is going to fall apart. Japan now attacks the United States, destroys the one third of the Pacific Fleet in one day. The Third Fleet destroyed one third of it in one day, December 7th, 1941. What does Sir John Templeton do? He calls his broker and says, I want you to buy every bankrupt company on the New York Stock Exchange. You understand? He invested when there's blood in the streets. Blood in the water, blood in this ocean. 4 years later, some of those companies were probably gone, but the ones that came back, Mr. John Templeton, now Sir John Templeton, well, he passed away a few years ago, was a rich man. Would you have that kind of conviction? Courage? Yeah. And here are some Fabian Smithson stupid sayings. It can't go any lower. You'll hear people say that. It can't go any lower. When can it not go lower? When it hits zero. When it hits zero, it can't go any lower. Reminds me of that joke. The student goes up to the teacher and says, I don't think I deserve this grade. And the teacher says, I don't think you deserve it either, but I can't give you less than zero. Okay? It can't go any higher. Oh, yes, it can. That's what they kept saying about Procter & Gamble and Philip Morris. It can't go any higher. Oh, yes, it can. If the earnings are growing, it's only $3 a share. What can I lose? Everybody wants to say $3. Well, it's only $3 a share. What can I lose? It's only 25 cents a share. What can I lose? Yeah. It has to come back. No. You ever hear of Penn Central or Braniff Airlines? No. There's a reason why. They're gone. It's sometimes darkest before the dawn. Well, sometimes it's always darkest before it's pitch black. When it rebounds to $10, I'll sell. Now, I understand what you're saying here. I understand what's going on here. They bought it at $10. It's now $5 or $6 or $3. They want it to go back up so they can say, I didn't make a mistake. Because we're human. We hate to admit we're wrong. If you wouldn't buy it at $5 or $3 or $7, it's time to sell. And we're wired in a certain way, such that if we do sell, we will quickly forget about it. We're wired that way. We forget unpleasant experiences. It's part of our mechanism to cope. But if you hang on to it, every time you look at the screen or your statement, you're going to say, what a dumb screwball I was. You're going to keep reminding yourself how stupid you were. If you think the future for the stock is bright, if you would buy it now at $6, sure, hang on to it. In fact, you might want to buy more. Do you understand? But if you're holding on to it so you can wait for it to come back to $10 because that's what you bought it at, that's a bad policy. In my humble opinion. And I'm not alone. I stole a lot of these from Peter Lynch. And you're going to, I tell you, you got to read one up on Wall Street. If it goes down 10%, sell. You understand what they're doing here? What are they trying to do here? They're trying to protect you against large losses. So if it looks like it's starting to go down, sell. The problem is that stock prices fluctuate. You know, if you did that, you'll sell your winners and, well, yeah, you'll always be selling stuff. So I don't think it's a good idea. It's taking too long. Well, patience is an investor's most important trait. And as we saw with the large cap, multinational, very large companies, it does take a long time. It doesn't happen overnight. Now, with the roll of the dice, small cap companies, some of which become big companies, sure, but for every one that does, there's 20 or however many that are going to fall into the porcelain oasis. So I don't suggest you do that. Maybe take 5, 10%, 20% of your portfolio. Look at all the money I lost. I couldn't buy it. Look at all the money I lost. I didn't buy it. I missed that one. I'll catch the next one. Well, that's not always true. The next one rarely makes it. Is there going to be another Microsoft in the software industry? No. There'll be another Microsoft, but it'll be a different technology. Understand? In fact, Microsoft, people are saying that they're setting in the sun. Their sun is setting. I don't necessarily agree with that, but sometimes there is the next one. Remember Home Depot? They pioneered that big box, put the mom and pop hardware companies out of business. And who came behind them? Lowe's, yeah. The stock has gone up. I must be a genius. Does it mean you're a genius if the stock goes up?
No.
No, there's an old saying, never mistake a bull market for brains. In fact, people in the industry will tell you, the worst thing that happened to them is they got in the industry just as the bear market started. They got in at 1982 or 1962 or whatever, when the market just skyrocketed, and they thought, I'm a genius, right?
And the income is making you lose money.
Exactly, yeah. And the stock has gone down. I must be an idiot. Not necessarily. It's just, you know, there's a lot of things out of your control. It's different this time. Well, technically, yes, it's different every time. But that doesn't mean you should pay an astronomical price for a company that probably will never make a dollar's worth of profit, the internet stocks. It's a new era. When you hear this one, it's usually time to sell. It's a permanent trend, huh?
Permanent trend?
You know what an oxymoron is? Jumbo shrimp. Straight, curve, military intelligence. Okay, stocks are too risky. true, right? Stocks are too risky. This is what you're going to hear from your friends and family. When they know that you're investing, they're going to say, oh, stocks are too risky. And you have to acknowledge that. You have to say, you know, there's a lot of risk involved. But even with all the stupidity, even with all the shenanigans, with all the funny business, they've still been the best long-term financial investment. And it worked for me so far. But who knows? The world could end. So that was chapter 7. You excited? You're just ready for spring break. Right? You're ready for spring break. All right. Well, any comments? Any thoughts? That usually is pretty, it's usually much, much more exciting. All right. Let's start chapter 8, and we'll do 10 minutes. I apologize. I want to make sure we get that. I don't want you to lose any of your hard-fought time here. This is where we really get silly, because we're going to eventually take a look at technical analysis, but we'll do that on Tuesday. We will also have time to review, study every day. But Benjamin Graham said it best. The investor's chief problem, and even his or her worst enemy, is likely to be himself or herself. So who's your worst enemy when you're investing? Often yourself. So, over the past 20-some-odd years, an entire new category of study called behavioral finance. But it's nothing new, folks. They just somebody's got to get their PhD, so they have to come up with a fancy name for it. As we said, Benjamin Graham knew it 70 years ago. Investor psychology? What? Investor what? I like to call it slycology. You like that? Slycology. So psychology, the study of psychotics. No. In 1962, but you got to realize that this is part of investing, folks. And you will see people who make the most rookiest mistakes, the most stupidest mistakes, and you try to say to them, well, you know, you try to turn the... I told you I was at a party with somebody with Apple a few months ago. She bought it, I don't know, around 600, so as it was climbing, she was so happy when it hit 700, and then it promptly fell to 500, and she was very, very bitter. Now it's down to 450 or whatever. And I kept trying to explain to her, but this is a company that's very volatile, and they should do well. And, oh, she wanted to hear nothing about it. They're crooks. They're scamming your money. Stay away from Wall Street. Okay.
So Apple's gone like 400
or something? Well, it's on our screen. Let's go look for it. You can't afford to buy one share? Then don't buy it. Where is it? Where's the Apple going for? 450, and we've only lost 6%. Whoa, look at Caterpillar. Caterpillar got hit. I guess people are worried about the global slowdown in China and India, because that's Caterpillar makes most of their money outside the United States. Yeah, okay. So here is one economist answer. This is nothing new, folks. It's nothing new. But you have to be ready for it in yourself and other people. In 1962, there was a brief recession and a sharp market downturn because the market in the 50s did really, really well. And then after 1962, it zoomed. The president's chief economic advisor was giving a presentation to many of the political and economic leaders of the time, describing what they were doing to right the economy. One of the attendees asks, so when is the stock market going to recover? The advisor curtly responded, I'm an economist, sir, not a psychiatrist. I thought it was funny. Because of the tremendous amount of money involved in the markets, much research has gone into trying to understand investor psychology. Some of the research is very revealing about who and what we are. Not only as investors, but as a species, as human beings, homo sapien homos. There's an old saying, there are three factors that influence the market. Greed, fear, and greed. You see, our greed usually, but not always, overcomes our fear. We see other people making money, we want to do it. Reading too much into the recent past. As we said in the previous section, beware the permanent trend. Even though there are countless examples of investors getting on the bandwagon, just as the wagon was about to veer into a ravine, we trick ourselves into believing that it's different this time. It's a new era. The old ways of valuing stocks or real estate or whatever are gone. You've got to get with the times and then watch it fall off the wagon. So are you piling into gold and treasury bonds now? A lot of people say that treasury bonds are the next bubble. They are, as we're going to see, very expensive when we get to bonds. I would not be personally, I ain't buying treasury bonds now. Did you buy oil in mid-2008 when it was $147 a barrel and then fell to $39 a barrel in 8 months? Now it's what, like 95 or so? How did that condo conversion flipper in early 2006 work out? Oh, not so good, huh? How about eToys, TheGlobe.com, or CMGI? Those were real companies, folks, with very large market capitalizations. These two are gone. This one, I think, is still around. And these are the people you really feel sorry for, the people who run with the crowd, because they usually get killed. They might be, you know, lucky enough to get out in time. Misperceiving randomness. Even though stock price movements in the short term are random, our brains will trick us into seeing a pattern. We humans are heuristic. You know what that word means? Heuristic? It means we look for patterns. As opposed to, I'm sorry? Yeah, we look for familiar things. Even if we've been told or we know that there's no pattern to be had, we will superimpose one. And in this, for example, if you are looking at a series of a million random digits, probability, the statistics and the probability say that in that series of a million digits, there should be at least one time when there are 13 digits in a row. That doesn't matter which one, 0 through 9, but there should be at least one time that we see 13 sixes or 13 zeros or 13 nines. Now, if you saw that, would you say, that's not random? You understand? You would say, that's not random. But if that didn't happen, that means it's not random. That means somebody's fudged the numbers. Because that should happen. And so we as humans will say, that can't be random because that's 13 in a row. We will, even though we're told, no, this is the truth, we won't trust it. And we're going to see on Tuesday, well, actually we get back next Tuesday, that this is what technical analysts do. In my humble opinion, they superimpose patterns that they should know better aren't there. And I think they get hammered from it. And then being overconfident. Believing you know more than you think you know, or believing you're better than most other investors. The truth is, we only see the tip of the iceberg with regard to what is happening within a company, an industry, or an economy. This is why I don't think I think it's hubris. You know, you hear the word hubris? I think I'm better than I am. When I go out and say, I can do better than a mutual fund company that has people all around the world, analysts all around the world. We are usually only average or mediocre investors at best, especially if we decide to become traders. Now, has anybody ever heard of Lake Wobegon and the Prairie Home Companion? No? Well, it's gotten into the language, right?
Swamp?
No, it's Minnesota. Minnesota. I'll tell you some Minnesota jokes later on. But this guy, Garrison Keillor, has made it into the language. It's called the Lake Wobegon effect, because he ends all of his stories with, that's the news from Lake Wobegon, where all the women are strong, the men are good looking, and all the children are above average. All the children are above average. Everybody can't be above average. How many people think they are excellent drivers? How many people think they're excellent drivers? Come on, raise your hands high. Excellent drivers. Come on, you'd be, go, come on, wake up. Wake up, Christian. Wake up, Victor. Excellent driver. How many people think they're good drivers? Raise your hands high. How many people think they're average drivers? Really? Would you have said that if I didn't start? How many people think they're fair drivers? Or poor drivers? You think you're a poor driver? Well, and if you got 100 people and you don't lead it up, I led you too quickly. I led you into this. But you get 100 people, nobody will say that they're poor. Maybe one person will say they're fair. And very few people will say they're average. Over 80% will say they're excellent or good. And that's the way we think when we start investing. We think we're a good investor. When it turns out we're probably not that good at all. But we think we are. So these are common investor weaknesses. And we will come back and continue with this on Tuesday. Study, study, study. I want you to do awesome. I want you to do awesome. I want you to be great investors and stockbrokers and financial analysts and insurance and banking. All right.